Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and I'm joined today by Joshua Ganz, the author of the well-timed Economics in the Age of COVID-19. This short book, 132 pages, is published by MIT Press and is the inaugural publication in a new series called MIT Press First Reads. For obvious reasons, the book was written at speed, and Joshua does warn the reader early on that it will need an update in the autumn. Nevertheless, it's packed with both the latest thinking in epidemiology and in what has worked and what hasn't in the economic policy response. He brings us historical precedent, such as the response to the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic and the economic reconstruction effort after 1945, as well as some interesting and heterodox ideas for what the public and private sectors should do next. Joshua holds the Jeffrey Scholl Chair in Technical Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Ruttman School of Management at the University of Toronto, where he also serves as Chief Economist to Creative Destruction Lab, a seed stage program for massively scalable science-based companies. Born in Sydney in 1968, Joshua went to school in Brisbane and at the University of Queensland before taking his PhD in economics at Stanford. From there, he returned to Australia to lecture at the University of New South Wales, then at Melbourne Business School, where he became a full professor in 2000. The author and co-author of weighty textbooks, including Principles of Microeconomics and Principles of Macroeconomics with Greg Mankey, Stephen King, and Robin Stonecash, Joshua also wrote Parentonomics back in 2010 and continues to blog on the subject of parenting and economics. Joshua, welcome.
Thanks.
Could you begin by explaining the story behind why and how you wrote this, as you describe it, hastily written book? Had MIT Press already come up with the idea of First Reads, or did your idea come first?
Well, I'm not 100% sure where First Reads, what its genesis is, but for my part, I was at home, as everybody else was, mid-March. And I wasn't really doing anything productive except obsessing over coronavirus infection figures and other things like that and trying to understand what was going on around us. And I thought to myself, you know, I can't just do this. I'm clearly not going to do any other work. I'm apparently going to neglect my children. So... aside from, well, the idea of, you know, homeschooling and other things like that, we hadn't quite worked out what we were going to do. But I thought, well, maybe I should just do what I seem to do best, which is write popular books that explain economics, you know, to a wider audience. And I should do it maybe for this as well. I could easily have just been blogging about it, but I thought that if I set myself the discipline of trying to cover all the bases in a book, I would come up with something that was of better use to everybody. And so that's really what happened. And then fortunately, I've had books published with MIT Press before. And so I did approach them because I wanted it to be a peer-reviewed book and published. But I basically said, you know, I'm not going to write this thing in a matter of weeks if you're going to spend 6 months publishing it. And so they basically said, no, we will work out, you know, this way of being able to do it quickly. Maybe with an alternative from their point of view, alternative branding to note that. And we were off to the races. So that's basically what happened. And I think they moved faster than any publisher has moved in history for any of these things.
That's an incredibly impressive feat. I mean, how many, basically, how quickly did you write it from starting to the last full stop?
Yeah, I looked at my first email to MIT Press before I'd started writing was on the 19th of March, and the book was published, just as an ebook because you can't get these things printed right now, on the 22nd of April. So that was just over a month from start to finish, which is, when you think about it, quite ridiculous.
What is your typical lag been in previous books you've written?
It sort of depends. I normally write books. I noodle over them for some months and develop research and collect things like that. And I like to write in bursts, so that's something I'm familiar with. But normally I write half a book, take a few months off and write the next half. A normal 6 months to a year process of just getting that done. And then it's usually 9 months or so before, by the time you submit a final draft to a publisher, that it actually comes out in print. So this virus, of course, you know, it couldn't wait that long. I mean, for starters, I'm already worried, and this is May, that the book is starting to get out of date, let alone what a normal process would give.
Well, except, I mean, one of the most useful parts of the book actually is the footnotes, the research that you refer to, the ongoing research you refer to, and the sort of interrelation between economics and epidemiology. Did you know much of that before you put fingers to keyboard, or did you stumble across that as you went along?
What happened, I think, is so I'd had some previous papers in health, but in health economics, but different elements of it to this. And what happened was there was a very small literature in economics about some of these things. A lot of it had to do with the AIDS epidemic, which has all sorts of interesting incentives and other problems that arise from it. So people had researched that. And there were a few other things around. But if you look at the footnotes in my books, are extraordinary, because just the academic papers alone, I'd say 80% of them were written during the time I was writing the book. So they just started appearing. So I wasn't the only person sitting at home wondering what to do. My economist colleagues were sitting there and saying, well, I should do something. And they each took their area of expertise and developed some COVID research around it. And it's been, it was certainly great for me because, you know, it's like I had an entire community that I was sitting on the shoulders of trying to digest these things, which I couldn't have done that on my own. And that's still ongoing as well. And so I think the thing we learned from this is epidemiology is one of these places that sits between medical science and social science. And I think what we're realizing now is that there's a lot of contributions to be had from the social science part of that equation. And I think this will be, you know, if we're looking for a long-lasting impact of this on science, I don't think these issues are, I think economists are going to concentrate on these issues far more intensively now. Because it's useful to understand it. And two, because on the economic side of the pandemic equation, we had not done enough thinking. We were wholly unprepared for how economic management should change, respond, react to a pandemic. It was previously was very simplistic. Oh, this thing comes in, it would be bad. It's disruptive. It's a, you know, it's a supply side shock, whatever. It's not really very useful, but actually there's a lot going on there. There are a lot of issues that need to be done. And a lot of the things that governments have been doing have been very much on the fly. Whereas I think we'll look back later on and wish we knew more and had thought about it at scientific cadence rather than crisis cadence.
Yeah, in fact, you say quite early on, you say, quote, having a clear and resolved approach to holding the line on health is warranted.
Yeah.
Is it fair, you think, to say that the foundation of the book is that the perceived trade-off between public health and economic activity, which is what we see in the press every day, that in this context is too simplistic and wrong-headed?
I think there's at different levels of it. So, you know, here in North America and the United Kingdom and much of Europe, the crisis is one where we're sort of it's already out of control in some sense. It's already got too big to handle, and so we are facing these brutal trade-offs seemingly between the economy and health. Now, that's at least how it's perceived. Once you expand the time frame, you realize the things aren't really trade-offs, but they sort of go hand in hand. And most economists will tell you, we need to solve the health problem in order to solve the economic problem. There's no sort of magic reopening and accepting a number of deaths type thing. People don't like to accept deaths, you know, especially their own. So I think it's more difficult than that. But in terms of the thing that you mentioned regarding resolve, which is how I put it in that book, which was basically pandemics have to be controlled and really dealt with when they're very hard to see the consequences of them right at the beginning. You sort of have to have plans and actions right there. And I think when we step back and look at who handled it best and who didn't, it will be the ones who had a plan and enacted that plan right away that did well. And obviously, you know, South Korea and Taiwan are at the top of that list. But I think also in terms of characterizing the problem, I would, you know, my view now, and certainly in the updated book version of this book, this will be said more emphatically than I did previously, is that pandemics are very manageable. I think there was a sense in March and April of fatalism. It's like, oh, look at this, a pox has come upon us. We must plow through as best we can. And of course, at that time, that's what had happened. But I think once we step back, we're going to say, actually, no, pandemics are very manageable. And it comes down to something that I call the pandemic information problem. And basically, if you know who is infected, you can isolate them and the virus or whatever doesn't spread. So in other words, the chief thing stopping us from being able to, stopping us from containing any virus is knowing who's infected. Now, once you sort of accept that, you realize that the early pandemic game is an information game. And you want to pour resources into solving that information problem, isolate, you know, people who are infected or probably infected, and then you can deal with this very quickly. And this isn't just a theory. With the SARS epidemic in 2003, you know, that was a very infectious coronavirus, as it turns out. And also far more deadly, about 10% case fatality rate rather than 1 or 2% as this might be. And they dealt with it very quickly. It was within a few months, the cases spiked and then they got crushed all the way back down because they aggressively found infected people. Now, the difference between SARS and the novel coronavirus today is that SARS presented its symptoms right away. It was flu-like symptoms. So basically, they took in the countries where there was an outbreak, all the people who had flu-like symptoms, isolated them, and then the virus died out. This time around, we don't have that luxury. We can't see the virus when it is initially infectious, when people are initially infectious. So we have to work much harder. But we also know that countries who understood that were able to deal with this very quickly. And so they didn't have to engage in lockdowns, and they were able to deal with it. And even the ones that engaged in lockdowns, like Australia and New Zealand, if they did testing and contract tracing, they were able to deal with it quickly as well. And so the great news there is that costs, the economic costs of a shutdown and prolonged shutdown were avoided. And so I think that's going to be our takeaway in the end. I think in the end, we're going to hopefully stand up and say, look, if we do our work, we shouldn't have to go through this again.
Yeah. And it's, in that respect, it's quite interesting, well, very interesting, in fact, the when you pointed out what happened in the small town of Vaud, northern Italy, the number of asymptomatic people who were then isolated, and then you had a massive drop in the in infection rates, and also the contrast between the way it was managed between Lombardy and Veneto. Do you think, though, Italy in a way acts as a pilot project for the rest of us?
Well, I wish it was yes, it should have. The problem we faced was that it was so unclear. I know this because I didn't know what was going on. It was so unclear at the beginning what was happening. And I think everybody knew that there was a sense in which whatever you did now didn't really show up for 2 to 3 weeks in something you could see in terms of infection rates or something else. Yeah. And so it was very hard to be clear on who might be in different paths or not when they've done different things. It just wasn't at all clear. And I think that's really hampered a lot of things. Now, that said, it's a good idea. You know, this is why you sort of have to hand over the management of this crisis to health officials who are basically going to say, well, this is what we need to do from a health perspective. And I understand you've got this economic problem, but we're going to have to do this because otherwise we're going to, end up with a far more prolonged situation. And I think right at that time, I don't think enough people believed that you could take the curve, it was called, not just flatten it, as they termed, but actually crush it and get rid of the virus. I think that certainly wasn't being communicated, and I'm not sure how much was understood. And the thing that can give us pause is that we can often point to, well, the United States, well, they were managing this particularly badly, and of course continue to do so, but it's and are paying the price for it. But it's not like everybody else had a clear record on this either. There are some missing things in our process that we really shouldn't have. The way I make it, it's akin to the situation in the Great Depression. One of the reasons that's accepted the Great Depression really happened was when there was a shock to the economy in terms of finance, instead of flooding the markets with liquidity and other things like that to grease the wheels of that, they did exactly the opposite and said, oh, we're going to get inflation or something. So they reduced the money supply. Now, that turned out to just send a whole lot of banks bankrupt much quicker and all that sort of stuff. And so that lesson was learned. And since then, every other time we have one of these crises, we now do the opposite. That's a game plan that occurs. And, central banks in particular have those plans available. And in this crisis here, there was even a broad consensus from economists of how to handle it. It's just that we hadn't gone through all the details of it. And I'm, while I'm confident that everybody did the right thing, and would do it again given the information they had. I can imagine in some month's time or maybe a bit longer, we're going to look back and say, we really shouldn't have done that. That was too costly, didn't work, et cetera. And so, you know, because it was done in a crisis, this program was abused terribly and what have you. So this is where we have to do a lot more work, because these things this is not the last one of these.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
But are you implying that the next time around, policy should aim to crush the curve? And obviously for that to work, and you talk about this at the end of the book, for that to work, you require a really effective, essentially an IMF of pandemics. Would that be your chosen approach rather than this kind of flattening the curve, which means that you can manage the infections, but you actually prolong the pandemic?
I think so. I think, and we might, maybe evidence will come to the contrary, but I take heart that with SARS and MERS, the curves were crushed. And in certain countries around the world, the curves were crushed in this one as well. So that tells me that is possible. What you want to do is do that everywhere. And in particular, what you want to do is have it be crushed in the country or countries that initially are hit by whatever virus is emerging. And so there are kind of multiple points of failure. You know, once the virus has left that particular country and is everywhere, I think there are still opportunities for investments in information to crush the curve worldwide. What would be better is if it didn't leave its initial region and could be contained more quickly there. And, you know, it's not a thing of trying to work out blame. I don't think there are many governments in the world that are trustworthy enough to hold their finger in the leaking dam for the rest of the world. And so I would rather, like the IMF or the United Nations, see a supranational authority with some ability to go in and manage these crises above the national interest of the country involved, at the time. I think it's just too big a calamity to not have that. And that could be anywhere it could go. These viruses emerge in all sorts of different countries, and what we need is global, worldwide monitoring so that they can be identified and then dealt with quickly.
Again, related to that, I really like the idea, and these are quite new concepts to me, the idea of stopping the clock, which you picked up from the Marginal Revolution blog.
Yes.
And the concept of a dark recession. So in the kind of policy response you're talking about, which is extremely severe, with luck, very quick, would your optimal policy response be one that is about stopping the clock? And could you expand further on your idea of what a dark recession is as opposed to a standard recession?
Yeah. So in terms of stopping the clock, if the virus breaks out in a particular country, some virus somewhere breaks out in a particular country, We can invest in information to try and contain it, but we may also, if it's particularly virulent and other things like that, want to impose basically restrictions on movement. So we have to shut down an economy in order to do that. And I think that the best metaphor for how we want to do that how we want to do that is we want to be able to shut down things. And I call it a pause. Some people call it stopping time. Others call it hibernation or a medical induced coma, whereby the goal is, yes, we shut it down, but the goal of the policies are directed at being able to just press play again and start from where we left off. And, you know, I know that we can do this for probably a month or two, so long as nobody's sort of closing down business, people losing their jobs, et cetera, and people have enough money to be able to service their basic needs. We can do that. And we know we can do that because we essentially do that one month a year in most countries. You know, France empties out. Paris empties out during the summer. Australia and New Zealand do it in January. US does it in August. Basically the economy just pauses and people seem to be able to do it. So I think that is a sound affair. But what you'd want to do is not sort of like have people saying, oh, where do we have to do this? And suddenly writing legislation, throwing billions of dollars at various bits of it like whack-a-mole, but something more sensible to be able to sort of hit the switch on, and all of a sudden everything, okay, we're in pause mode, here's what happens, and everybody understands that. And I think if we can do it with confidence that it was going to be just 2 months, which is what at least some of these economies suggest it could be, then it's manageable. The problem we have now is we did it, but not there was no end date. no end date. So, that's a real problem now that we're getting to the end of that point and people don't know where the money's going to come from and things like that, and the virus is still running around. So it's a problem. The second part of your question, which was about dark recessions, well, this was imagining, but it's not fully imagining, if we have one of these viruses that causes a lot of death and sickness, if we let that run its course, it's going to actually have an impact on, well, for want of a better term, labor supply. we get our wealth from people who make things. And if a lot of people are sick or worse, that becomes a problem and a constraint, let alone the effects of that in terms of people's behavior. And we saw that, at least in human history, with the Black Death, for instance, the bubonic plague in medieval times. It really had a terrible effect on the population and therefore the economies for centuries. So we certainly wouldn't want something like that to occur here. I think in many respects we should think ourselves of as extremely lucky with the coronavirus. It has a high fatality rate, too high, but not ridiculously high. MERS has 50%, so 1% is far lower than that. And secondly, in terms of people getting sick, we should also be very grateful that it wasn't the children getting sick as they did with polio or something like that. And so I think, and all that would have had a far bigger effect. You wouldn't have to lock down the economy at all if children were getting sick. No one was going anywhere. So I think those are things where we've been lucky, but we should take this ultimately as a very costly warning sign to get our house in order.
Yeah, and on that, I mean, you talk about the idea of creating a new Manhattan Project and a new Bretton Woods. Do you think also to make the idea of stopping the clock as an option credible in the future, we should all globally do something like the Norwegians did when they discovered oil and build a huge fund? Because if this is going to happen in repeatedly, I think markets are going to find it hard to believe that nationally fiscal policy will be able to cope with it.
I think there is some case to really being working on that. There are all sorts of different models about it, and I must admit I don't know which would be the right way to go, and let alone global coordination over these things. But, you know, I think it would certainly be worthwhile thinking about that, given the sums of money that had to be sort of just checks written to deal with this. And I think one of the fallouts from this will be when we look at this and say, well, we didn't have to spend half of this, or half of it was directed the wrong way, is we should have a better plan for this. And we did this with the financial sector and being able to deal with those. You know, it is surprising how well that works. I mean, basically in 2008, 2009, we can sort of claim that it was a catastrophe, but really it was a Great Depression level of risk going on, and the system broadly worked to stop that happening. And I think we could probably do the same here. And I think one of the reasons that it gives me confidence we could do so is that we should start to think about, you know, how little we were spending on anything preventative here to do with this relative to what we spend on wars and other things, etc. It seems like, you know, there should be an appetite to vastly increase our spending on catastrophe prevention. Catastrophes aren't good. Catastrophes are, you know, like, I know it's easy to say, it's very easy to say that now, but let's be very clear. You know, people were saying, you know, Bill Gates gave a speech in 2015, a TED Talk. And he said, here's what's going to happen if there's a pandemic. And basically, it's exactly what happened. So it was not like, you know, it was not that controversial that this was going to occur. The Obama administration, you know, put it as their biggest thing that they had to try and educate the Trump administration on in transition of power. Such was the risk of these pandemics. And that's just that. And we haven't even got to other things that could be catastrophes in the world that people have talked about that are a bit more slow moving, like climate change. And so I think if there's ever a message to get from this crisis, if we want to not let a good crisis go to waste, it'll be changing our understanding of how we prepare for these things, how much we put aside societal-wise to be able to deal with this.
And you make a very interesting point at the end of the book, referring to the I forget who wrote the research now, but the idea that it is possible to walk and chew gum at the same time. It is possible to prioritize this and prioritize climate change. Could you expand on that a little?
Well, yeah. So I was a bit worried. You know, one of the things that comes up with these crises, you sort of say, well, you know, we don't have. Let me put it this way. If you have two crises that could occur, a pandemic that really harms people and a climate catastrophe that really harms people, there's a tendency to think as, oh, look at all these catastrophes that could occur. Even if we deal with one, we're going to have to deal with the other. And so does this mean that I have to push hard on every single catastrophe I can ever imagine, all the way to evil robots taking over the earth or whatever, and I have to think about all of that before dealing with any of them? And, you know, my answer to that was, you know, no, is that really it's the case for any of these given catastrophes that the benefits of spending some amount of money to lower the risk of it are so high that just do the ones you're already aware of.
Yeah,
do that, and it will still be worthwhile expenditure going on. Yes, it is true that we may not have there's maybe some massive comet that we don't have the ability to stop hitting us now, and if we spend all our time trying to save the planet, it's not worth it. That is true, but that's a still low probability event, and we are better off preparing ourselves for the good scenario whereby we save the planet, and we're able to enjoy the fruits of that for centuries.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, you are working on an update to this book at the moment, I believe. When will we see the update published?
So that's coming on a little bit more normal publication schedule. It will appear in November in actual real print as well as an ebook. It'll probably be about 50% to 75% bigger with more content than the current book, including some interesting issues regarding, you know, how you tell the truth in managing these crises, privacy, and also thinking about the upcoming issue we're going to have regarding vaccine rationing, which I sort of touched on in the book, but yes. I think as an economist that required some more attention.
Maybe you could design the auction.
I don't think it's going to be an auction. That's what we don't want.
But design the lottery.
Yeah.
And beyond that, what books do you expect to be working on? Maybe into next year.
Oh. I don't know. I will probably pick up old projects, such as I've been working on a textbook on entrepreneurship for some time. So that'll be the next thing there. I still haven't quite got myself into the mindset of the future yet.
Yeah. Well, yeah. None of us has. Well, thank you very much for doing this interview.
Thank you.